Just a quick announcement before we start today. The History of Food is finally on Patreon. Getting laid off from my job as a chef due to COVID-19 inspired me to finally give in and open up the possibility if any of you would like to support the show. Some had already expressed an interest in the past, so I don't feel too bad about begging for your money on the internet, but seriously, if you just enjoy the show and don't want to give, feel no guilt. Just keep listening and spreading the word, and I already have so much gratitude that you're even here listening to this in the first place. But if you do want to become a patron of the show, getting access to benefits like being shouted out on anthrochef.blog and episode posts, 24-hour early access to new episodes, special recipes, or even personal cooking advice, visit patreon.com/historyoffood, all one word. Now, on with the show. What makes a great meal? Is it the ingredients? The skill in preparing them? The balance of flavors and dishes? You can make cases for all of those components. Ultimately, though, I think it comes down to satisfaction, or how a meal makes you feel. There's a reason that the flavors we love to eat the most are often nostalgic ones that we associate with other fond memories of earlier, more innocent times in our lives. The simple feeling of contentment given by a nourishing meal, even better if prepared by someone you love, is unmatched and has been for human beings since our very beginnings. As a career chef, I have to believe I know something about these components as to what makes a meal great, but there is a philosophy about it that I hadn't ever personally considered until researching this very episode. And it might just cut to that essence of contentment better than anything I would have come up with before. The reason I hadn't considered it is because it mostly exists outside of my normal frame of reference, scattered across the myriad different cultures of sub-Saharan Africa. It's quite simple, really. A great meal is the one that makes you feel the most full and satisfied. All over the vast continent of Africa, in places we don't learn enough about, you will find reverence for what it feels like to have eaten, and that people consider great chefs to be the ones who are most skilled at invoking that feeling, at making you feel full. So let's look backwards across time from our current vantage point in the colonial era and dig into the far more ancient history and cuisine of Africa south of the Sahara. Thus far on the history of food, we've stuck with the descendants of those humans who left the African continent for the most part, slowly filtering out to populate the rest of the world and eventually begin urban civilizations. Since stepping or rowing out into Arabia and then Europe and Asia, we've hardly looked back at the lands where it all began. There's a few reasons for that. And I'll be honest, a big part is the intimidation factor I've talked about before. Again, I'm a product of Western biases and school systems, and I just don't know nearly as much about African history as I do European history or others. As I am very much an armchair history fan, episodes on topics like that scare me, and that means I tend to put it off. But I have some legitimate excuses, too. A lot has changed in African cuisine in just the last few centuries, with the exchanges of colonial ingredients between the Old and New World hemispheres. By having waited until we've come this far chronologically, and having the background knowledge of the last few episodes published only recently, will give us a more comprehensive picture of African cuisine today than if we had started earlier. Also, the nature of what we know about African history is hard to fit into a broad history of the world context such as this podcast. Africa is an absolutely enormous landmass, not really much smaller than Asia if you look at it on a globe, And there are hundreds and hundreds of different peoples and cultures across its history and topography. So probably the biggest mistake you can make about Africa is imagining it as one big homogenous place. And yes, I do realize I'm not helping the issue by trying to fit it all into one episode, but I've put it off long enough and it's time to start. Most people, when asked to recall the great empires of history, can recall Rome and Greece, Egypt, maybe even Mesopotamia. But does anybody bring up the Axum Empire, or Mali, or Songhai? Maybe you do, and hopefully after today you definitely will. As we've seen again and again in other places, there is no single pan-African identity, or even pan-Sub-Saharan identity about very much at all. This is, after all, a continent that the modern USA could fit into three times over. Really, it should go without saying that such a large and diverse place would generate a good amount of interesting historical activity. But the problem is, we just don't know much of it. That's because Sub-Saharan Africa never had much use for written words until relatively recently, and held on to its oral traditions for longer than other places in the world. History was passed down verbally for ages, and there are almost no written primary sources until the 19th and 20th centuries. What historians do know, they know mostly from what has been recorded in only the last 100 or so years, as writers try to copy down those oral histories before they're lost. When that fails, historians turn to records written by outsiders, or less precise sources of information like paleobotany, linguistics, and cultural anthropology, taking what we can study in the present and extrapolating it back into the past. A very fraught and not reliable method for understanding history. For too long, historians with racist biases assumed that a lack of writing meant a lack of sophistication. But most scholars today recognize that oral tradition is merely an alternate way of forming civilization. Heck, when writing was invented in the ancient world, scholars at that time decried it as a lazy technology that would ruin everybody's memories. From the perspective of an only verbal society, they were kinda right. I bet my memory is garbage compared to a Malian griot. Yes, written records defined Western civilization, and have the advantage of lasting longer, and being something we can still read today, which is why historians so obviously favor them. But our modern prejudice against oral histories doesn't mean they can't produce amazing works. Look no further than the Iliad and the Odyssey, which were transmitted by oral tradition for centuries before they were ever written down. But Africa does not need ancient Greece to provide its own examples of the benefits of oral tradition. Those griots I mentioned from the Malian Empire were famous for their ability to recall the details of political history and its cultural meaning going back generations. Outsiders who witnessed these historians/mythmakers at the time were more than impressed at this rich way of remembering and relaying history and recalling information. So the history of Sub-Saharan Africa is not at all less important than Eurasian and other world history. It's just more difficult to study and discuss comprehensively with modern methods, and thus it is neglected, myself being just as guilty. This is just a convenient excuse, but ultimately, that's what it is. An excuse. The fault lies in our own education and history-relaying systems, and ultimately with our own personal responsibilities at knowing history. European history is treated as the ultimate narrative, but Africa is an afterthought. And what history does happen there always seems to begin with colonialism and the slave trade, which just happens to be when Europeans started interacting with it. There are thousands of prior years of history in Africa, much of it not so different from the European stuff. Kingdoms, rulers, trade and commerce, art, culture, and science. Africa has always had urban civilization and thriving cities, and still does today. Unfortunately, we just don't remember them all. Africa's culinary history is not so different, and yet also quite different too. While written recipes would come to define the food of Europe and Asia, cooking and family recipes remained fundamentally passed down verbally in African societies. Just like the oral historians, African chefs have long shown a remarkable ability for generational memory in their techniques and recipes. And in this case, the cooks may outperform the historians. So much African history has died with its keepers, but food preparation survives down the ages. When it comes to eating and cooking, ancient tradition can still pass down just fine without written words. So where should we begin today? How about we go way back? Of course, sub-Saharan Africa is where human beings first originated. And that means, if you'll recall all the way back to episode 1, that sub-Saharan Africa is where we would have first learned to cook. Without humanity's second stomach, so to say, the roasting fire or the stew pot, our pre-digestion technology of cooking extracted the maximum nutrients from otherwise inedible foods, without which we could have never evolved our human brains in the first place. It's hard to say when cooking was invented exactly, or which even of the numerous early hominid species was the first to do it, but we do know it happened before modern humans, and that means it happened first in Africa. In this way, the foods and cuisines of Africa have left a deeper imprint on the human psyche and DNA than perhaps any other. Just thought I should remind us all of that little fact, that the very earliest cuisine was African cuisine. By the time Homo sapiens did come around, take over, and eventually start leaving the continent too, the general shape and geographic regions of Africa had coalesced, but there was also much that was different about the continent in prehistory. For one thing, that vast and most famous of deserts, the Sahara, which itself defines sub-Saharan Africa, was not always a desert. It wasn't even semi-desert. Instead of being an impassable sea of sand dunes and dry heat, it was a lush and fertile grassland. On geological timescales, this actually happens pretty frequently. Changes in the Earth's orbit around the sun mess with the North African monsoon season and regularly transform the Sahara back and forth between desert and savanna. Before 15,000 years ago, it was actually drier and hotter than it is today. But in the late Pleistocene and the early Holocene, when humans had made their way all over the planet but were still Stone Age hunter-gatherers, the Sahara was green. And as a result, rivers, lakes, woodlands, and forests expanded from it like tendrils all over the continent. It was boon times for foragers. Cave paintings of savanna animals in the area show that humans inhabited the region long ago, ranged and hunted a variety of big game across it, as well as harvesting wild cereal grasses across what were grasslands while it lasted. By the time humans started settling into agricultural societies, the Sahara was already drying out again. As the vast sea of grass died out, huge amounts of people who had occupied the fertile lands were displaced. They gathered in groups together around what lakes and oases remained, like islands across the growing desert. They moved with animals from one to another and developed rich pastoral cultures in the process. This drying cycle of the Sahara may have been what drove such large population numbers crowding around the still fertile Nile River to the far east. Forced to figure out a way to grow and expand their wild grains to feed all these climate refugees, thus kickstarting one ancient civilization. So the massive drying out of the Sahara and regions beyond probably played a big role in the earliest stirrings of urban civilization. But what about the rest of Africa? Africa south of the Sahara, the subject of this episode? By about 9,000 years ago, or 7,000 BCE, dense forests had dramatically subsided, but open woodlands and bush and dry grasslands remained. This is when I'll begin the history of sub-Saharan African food, when you can say it officially diverged somewhat from others. While North Africa, the Middle East, and Egypt, and Central Asia all dried out, and people largely turned to farming and village life to survive, sub-Saharan Africa remained a forager's continent for a lot longer, and people could still depend on their local environments and wild foods for sustenance. For example, on the vast savanna-covered plateaus, the abundance of game animals allowed meat to be consumed regularly, along with a variety of nuts, berries, roots, and gathered tubers. Meat became harder to come by in more densely forested habitats, but freshwater fish was widely available as a replacement and complement to vegetable foods, whereas along some coastal sections, extensive remains testify to the dietary importance of shellfish. Virtually all of the continent appears to have been occupied by multiple societies, at least on a seasonal basis. The only exceptions where foragers didn't thrive appear to be the very highest elevations, the heart of the Sahara Desert, and the narrow strip of the Namib Desert, as well as the deepest recesses of the equatorial rainforest, but we're talking Heart of Darkness stuff here. Africa today still has the greatest biodiversity of wild food sources than any other place. This is why some parts of Africa remained hunter-gatherers longer than almost anywhere else in the world, even up to modern times. But again, it's still not universal. Farming societies and pastoralism arose a bit slower than elsewhere in the world, but that doesn't mean they didn't happen, or that Africa was solely some endless forager's Garden of Eden forever. People in the driest zones, especially those refugees from the once green Sahara, took up these new ways of making a living, and soon afterwards, farming villages had taken root and spread out, taking shape in the wooded savannas of West Africa, as well as around Lake Chad, which was much larger than it is today, and further east in modern Ethiopia. As these fledgling Neolithic economies spread, the pace of change varied considerably region to region. The norm was for herders and farmers to gain ascendancy over hunting, fishing, and foraging very gradually, meaning that the reality of Africa remained a patchwork of different economies across the rest of its history, neither fully agricultural, nor fully pastoral, nor fully hunter-gatherer. Rather, all three at once, in flux and various combinations simultaneously, depending on the specific people and circumstances. There's another reason that the Neolithic was slower to catch on south of the Sahara. Despite being blessed with lush savannas and a natural bounty of wild food, which sustained us and our hominid ancestors for millions of years, Africa is not so blessed with what you might call naturally agricultural foods, foods that are conducive to domestication. Oh, there's a few, which I'll cover, but Africa has nothing on the Middle East and other continents in this way. Take a look at wheat and barley, or other edible domestic grasses, which we know played an integral role in the first large societies. West Asia, Europe, and North Africa have more than 30 species of such grasses. The Americas even had 11. Africa south of the Sahara had just 4. As for domestic animals, native to Africa was the donkey, while the Fertile Crescent had goat, sheep, pig, and cow for itself. Though cattle would become essential to African foodways and societies, the continent actually did not have any possible ancestors of its own for these domestic species to develop. Africa south of the Sahara had to depend on external sources for all of these livestock, which seemed to have arrived in several waves coming from South and West Asia, coming into Egypt down the Nile, before moving further into southern and western Africa to breed into more distinctive African varieties only then. wheat and barley would likely have followed a similar route, but they did not make it past Egypt, most likely because they require winter rains, when Africa's wet season is in the summer. But again, these circumstances only slowed Africa down. If Africa had limited endowments of local domestic foods, it had no problem adapting those from the outside to its own ecologies. In fact, Africans' ability to incorporate foreign foods into their own ways became their greatest skill in building culinary tradition. And I am not just talking about colonial foods and the Columbian Exchange. Those will indeed influence African cooking in a great way down the line. But sub-Saharan Africa's globalization of its food supply is not that new. It has been on the receiving end of world trade and has been absorbing culinary ingredients and ideas from elsewhere with energy and imagination since its beginnings thousands of years ago. People in and across the desert, river traders down the Nile and Red Sea, sailors on the Indian Ocean, and eventually the Atlantic. When Europeans did arrive, around 1500 AD, they found a huge array of foreign crops already well adapted by African farmers and cooks. Not unlike what we discussed in the forming of Korean or Japanese society in relation to China, Africa used so many outside ingredients to build something new of its own. Only Africa took from just about everywhere. From Egypt and the Mediterranean, you get citrus, chickpeas, wheat, barley, onions, garlic, dates, goats, sheep, and cattle. Figs, melons, pomegranates are big, cucumbers. And from the Indian Ocean and Asia, you get yams, coconuts, mangoes, ginger, bananas, rice, sugar, and loads of other spices. Brewing coffee was learned from Yemen, and steaming couscous from North Africa. Many of these foods are now quintessential to African cooking, but they didn't start out that way. Every region of sub-Saharan Africa has chosen what it liked and what worked for it, creating quite a smorgasbord of cultural ingredients, techniques, and tastes across the continent. Some people like spiced and spicy food. Others like a bland but hearty fullness from grains and stews. Even cultures that shared some of these broad preferences, though, would approach them in different ways. For example, what kind of starch do you use to make your filling staple? That depends on a number of things. Before we get into those details, looking at how some of these earliest ingredients made their way into Africa and what happened once they did can provide a little more interesting context. Academic research has shown that domestic cattle was in use in Africa thousands of years before domestic plants, so early that it was thought until recently that an entirely separate cattle domestication event had occurred in Africa. Now, this turned out to not quite be the case, as what were once thought to be different species of cattle are actually different families derived from the same original wild oryx from the Near East. It still demonstrates how early and important herding livestock was to many sub-Saharan African cultures, long before farming was. So-called cattle-assisted hunter-gatherers were already in operation around Lake Chad as early as 9,000 years ago, probably originally using cows as food insurance policies in their drying-out Sahara, as well as a source of fat, and then since they were kept well-fed for that purpose, milk, blood, and meat economies could develop afterwards, just like we talked about in episode 12 on herders. Importantly, though, for thousands of years, these African proto-pastoralists remained foragers, who happened to keep some cattle around, harvesting wild grasses and other foods more commonly rather than planting them. Further befuddling historical assumptions are these agriculturalist herders' advanced cultures. Without having towns or temples, pastoralists on the edges of the desert began to worship their animals and bury them in elaborate graves and make art about them. And then you have the fact that these herder-forager hybrids can and do make pottery. Ceramics was supposed to be an urban invention that only came with settled farming villages, made explicitly for the purpose of storing and protecting grain. And yet, even without that grain, many sub-Saharan cultures knew how to make earthware and containers before they ever picked up a farming trowel. Archaeologists aren't sure if the first Africans who did start to farm were originally sedentary or mobile, or if they were foragers or pastoralists. Knowing what we've learned already, they were probably a combination of all those things. Even though the rest of the world was hogging all the domesticable grains, Africa did quite well with what it had, domesticating all the ones that could be domesticated. First up, in the Nabta Playa region surrounding parts of southwest Egypt and Ethiopia today, where those cattle-worshipping pastoralists were living, there appears to have been some dabbling in cultivation of sorghum. What the heck is sorghum, anyway? Most of us have probably heard of it at best, unless you've got older relatives from the Deep South, USA. It's related to and often confused with millet, but sorghum is much sweeter and can be cooked down into a syrup. Today, it's mainly grown as animal fodder, but it's still an important staple today in India and its home continent of Africa, especially in the drier areas, just like where it was originally domesticated. Sorghum seeds can be cooked as grains like rice, or into porridge, or ground into flour for unleavened breads, and the cane syrup has often been used over the ages as a malt and mash to flavor and brew alcoholic beverages, especially beer. From Northeast Africa, sorghum spread to the Near East, India, China, and one day far in the future to the New World and the USA, where it became a very important colonial food. Sorghum migrated around with the people carrying it, planting it, and eating it, and eventually made its way to the way more agriculturally productive region of West Africa. West Africa is an enormous, ethnically and geographically diverse region as large as the United States. Around the time that the Green Sahara was drying into desert, West Africans began to turn more to livestock, and as things just got drier and drier, those herders were driven ever further southward away from the desert, possibly seeking respite by depending more on the cultivation of wild foods, learning agriculture over the generations in the process. Mixed economies of fishing, hunting, gathering, and herding in all sorts of combinations incorporated farming too. In what is now south-central Mauritania, you have growing populations coalescing into larger villages after they domesticate millet. We've talked about millet plenty in episodes about other cultures it's important to, namely ancient China and its satellite civilizations, without which society there would never have gotten started as early as it did. Millet is native to and was first domesticated in West Africa at least 5,000 years ago. After this point, though livestock and wild foods remained important sources of sustenance, farming took over a little bit and took quite well to the lands of West Africa. Archaeological evidence suggests that highly centralized communities with quite sizable populations had developed by the 2nd and 1st millennium BC, with extensive trade networks, ironworking technology, terracotta artworks, and other elements of distinct culture. These societies expanded their territory to take agriculture from a fringe activity to a very common survival strategy. West African farming societies were so successful that soon they had made their way to the fringes of the deep equatorial rainforest, from which they added a few more crops to their inventory, namely okra, native to here and can be crispy or gooey in stews. This highly productive western half of the fledgling agricultural zone would go on to domesticate Bambara groundnuts, and a bit later on, African rice. This rice is a second, totally separate domestication event for wild rice. Sorry, India. Basmati rice is derived from the original Chinese crop. The short African variety, though, is original and would be crucial to some later African empires like Ghana, Mali, and Songhai. More on them in a bit. Africans would, of course, go on to take their rice and many ways of cooking it to America in captivity, and basically invent Cajun and Southern cuisine in the process. But we'll talk more about that another time. I gotta stay on track here because we have a lot to cover. What are some other early domestic crops native to ancient sub-Saharan Africa? Well, let's cover the last of the grains. We already got sorghum and millet, and there's still the somewhat more obscure teff. Another relative to millet, you may have had or be familiar with teff because it's still used to make the Ethiopian staple injera, that cuisine-defining, huge, flat, spongy, and slightly sour flatbread used as both platter, utensil, and sauce and stew vessel. Today, injera, stews, and legume pastes are still the major staples of an Ethiopian or Eritrean meal. Here's one you probably don't see coming. The oldest domesticated plant from Africa is not a grain, but the humble ancestor of today's juicy watermelon, of which domesticated seeds date to 4000 BCE. The wild watermelon is actually horrible, little gourds that grow in the dried riverbeds of the northern savannas. But they have seeds you can roast up and eat. Not a bad portable snack to have on hand, especially for long journeys through dry lands and ever-growing deserts. The watermelon with fruit and rind we eat now was actually not developed until Roman times. As far as it's come, all modern watermelons descend from those dinky little gourds in West Africa that people grew to snack on their seeds. The next African staple I want to mention is not exactly a domestic crop, but its products play a role in building civilization nonetheless. Palm trees can be tapped for juice, which then can be fermented into palm wine if you give it the right enzymes by spitting in it. Alongside grain beers, palm wine was the native alcohol of choice across much of the sub-Saharan landscape, until the arrival of distilled spirits in the colonial era. Long before that, though, palm wine was one of the ancient world's earliest traded commodities, brought by caravans across deserts to all over the old world. Additionally, palm trees are a useful building material, and palm oil, of which the real stuff is not like the industrial white oil we buy in America today, but rather a dark red with distinctive, nutty flavor. It's still the most popular African cooking medium and fat today. I think that about covers it for native crops and local ingredients to Africa. But remember, that's not the full story of the cuisine here. Foods from elsewhere still had a huge role to play. And one very important ingredient is yams, which various African communities have been cultivating and experimenting with since at least 5,000 years ago, when they made their way over from Southeast Asia. They found a wide popular growing zone in the mixed savanna woodland ecosystem of West Africa. And this is perhaps one of the earliest instances we see of Africa taking an ingredient from the outside and turning it into a staple so central, so ubiquitous, that you'd swear it was native there. Yams are often confused with sweet potatoes, which they sort of resemble, but are not really the same at all, or even genetically related. The flesh of a yam is really closer to like a turnip, even when cooked. And they can contain as much as 40% starch, making them full of nutritious and filling carbohydrates. African yams can be the size of a modern sweet potato, or they can range from 30 to 100 pounds. Seriously, Google giant yams and be amazed. Growing yams is also super low maintenance. Providing some decent basic conditions, you can plant them and then forget about them until it's time to harvest. Come back later another time of the year. perfect for semi-nomads who haven't quite settled down into farming life, but are transitioning into agriculture. Yams in West and Central Africa are consumed roasted, boiled, fried, or pounded. The pounded version becomes something called fufu, a thick, gelatinous mass and a definitive African staple. Let me come back to fufu in just a bit, but know for now that many West Africans, even today, particularly in Ghana, consider yam fufu to be the very best and the pinnacle of a meal. Another foreign, though now basically African, crop that arrived a bit later are plantains and bananas, also from Southeast Asia. These were critical to the formation of African civilization in key areas. Before their arrival, roughly 2,000 years ago, Africans had no high-yielding crop which could be produced and support villages in the wettest regions of the equatorial rainforest. But with the starchy and sweet arrival of plantains and bananas, African farmers could now spread outside of their woodlands and river valleys and colonize the deep forest. Now able to survive in and across the rainforest, agriculture could spread to every part of the continent, minus the deep Sahara. Plantains in particular remain extremely useful staples. They aren't as sweet relative to a banana, but they are much starchier instead. They can be boiled in green form to steam in its own leaves. You can grill it, fry it, or pound it into paste and fufu, or make it into flour. Plantains make a great snack or a core element of a meal, with stews and sauces absorbing right into the neutral flavor. Plantains are still very popular today, but in the era before maize and cassava came from the New World, they were especially critical sources of carbs. And then just very briefly, there are some other kinds of ingredients, especially foraged ones, that found their ways into the African cuisines, both in the ancient world and the contemporary. By far the most common are greens of one kind or another, picked from a variety of sources, cooked down into just about every stew recipe. Okra, we mentioned, groundnuts, mushrooms are quite good in a hearty stew or soup. Also, termites are a popular and entirely uncontroversial snack, as are many varieties of caterpillars, snails, and other mollusks. Protein is protein, but if you think that's gross, a few Africans would take issue with some things you eat. Some people, particularly in and around parts of Kenya, refuse to eat eggs, because they consider them a form of chicken excrement. I'll return to some of the ways all of these interesting ingredients are cooked, come together, and are eaten. For now, though, keep them in mind as the most common central staples, because I'd like to talk a little bit more about some of these African civilizations themselves before we finish exploring their cuisine. Here are just some of the other notable areas of activity in the ancient and classical African world, in not much of a particular order. On the other side of the continent from where we just were, somewhat removed from the expansion of West African farming societies, the Horn of Africa was the choke point between the continents. On the coast of what is now Somalia, the ancestors of the people still living there today were sailors and merchants who connected ancient sub-Saharan Africa to the rest of the world. They brought vital goods from Egypt, Phoenicia, Mesopotamia, and even far-flung Greece and Central Asia. Probably some of those classic domestic crops like wheat and barley eventually made their way to Africa via Somali sailors. In return, the Somalis were the world's main suppliers of frankincense, myrrh, and many local spices, which were immensely valuable luxuries to other ancient civilizations. A bit later on in the classical era, these trading ports grew into several flourishing city-states, which competed with the Parthians and ancient Rome and other Eastern empires in the rich network of trade between the Greco-Roman world, Central Asia, and the Far East. Yes, Africa too got in on the Silk Road game. The residents of Africa's Horn controlled sea routes in and out of the continent, But what about land powers in the very same area? Surprisingly early on in the history of civilizations, on the southern border of Egypt sat the kingdom of Kush, which today often gets overshadowed by its northern neighbors, but at the time was a regional power in its own right for more than 1,000 years. Kush was Egypt's link to the rest of Africa, and despite Egypt's fame, civilization along the Nile River was actually more of an ebb and flow between the Kushites and the Egyptians. When Egypt's power waned, Kush was on the rise, and at one point they even ruled Egypt as their own dynasty. The Kushites were both trading partners and military rivals, worshipping many of the same gods and sharing many other religious customs. And yes, if you're wondering, they built their own pyramids. The lands around Kush were most likely the buffer zone over which cattle was exchanged between the Near East and the rest of sub-Saharan Africa, down the Nile River Valley into the rest of the continent. And you can follow those cows down that route to continue our African tour, into the mysterious historical land of Punt. Historians didn't know where Punt, referenced in many sources, exactly was, but are now pretty sure it's along the Red Sea coast and northern Somalia, perhaps at times extending across the water into Yemen, though this is not for certain. Meanwhile, a little later on and further up, in the highlands of Ethiopia and Eritrea where those sorghum-growing cattle herders lived, you have the classical Iron Age kingdom of Aksum come about, which also just went by Ethiopia at times. Contemporary with the Roman Empire, as well as Han China, Aksum was a trading juggernaut whose gold and ivory supplies were the envy of the entire ancient world. Aksum smelted iron tools and weapons, they built distinctive architecture and massive stone obelisks, and they even wrote one of the very first written African scripts. Aksum's power waxed and waned over the years, but it remained influential for quite some time. This trading empire was an early adapter of Christianity, whose legacy remains today as the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, one of just three main branches of the faith in the world today. Between these northeastern trading empires, as well as the rise of the agriculturalists in West Africa, farming and urban life was beginning to take over sub-Saharan Africa. We see the rise of large societies especially accelerate, with another major milestone beginning back in West Africa, in what's called the Bantu Expansion, when some of those sorghum and millet farmers, specifically the Bantu language-speaking peoples of the woodland regions of central West Africa, moved deeper into the woods, penetrating the frontiers of the deep rainforest and thereby colonizing much of the southern part of the continent. The Bantu peoples had modest, quite small beginnings in just West Africa, but they would go on to take over much of the continent. The first Bantu migrants left their home in what is today southern Cameroon, using their new crops to trek and cultivate the wild and wet lands of the rainforest on their way. They spread African farming staples and picked up newer ones to help settle new areas, like cattle or yams, and then plantains, which, like we discussed before, were key to setting up civilization in the normally inhospitable rainforest. Now, more than ever, people were defined by what they ate. The Bantu migrants ate more so-called civilized dishes of grain, milk, and veggie crops, as well as fermented products, while the primeval Congo residents they displaced subsisted mainly on hunted meat in roasted or jerky form, and also foraged for wild tubers. Supposedly, the still quite strong love of barbecue in South Africa traces its roots back to these original inhabitants, but I couldn't confirm that fact, and it kind of sounds like a myth. Let's keep following the Bantu through sub-Saharan Africa. Some Bantu peoples came out the east side of the woods and brought farming and iron work to the local herding cultures of East Africa. Over the years, Bantu migrants claimed much of this Great Lakes region and connected and mingled with the coastal cities up in the Horn. Later on, these same people would adopt many Islamic, Arab, and Persian influences from over the Indian Ocean, combining forces to make the famous Swahili culture. Here we will see the rise of a collection of separate but interconnected trading powers, ancient Phoenicia or Carthage. Great ports like Mogadishu, Zanzibar, Mombasa were once quite racistly assumed to have been founded by Persian traders since they were supposedly just too advanced for East Africa. But historians now recognize this as false. Sure, these cities had trade links to Persian and Islamic cultures and took on many influences from them, but the descendants of the Bantu people deserve credit for their own achievements. Even so, Swahili cuisine is quite well influenced by the Near East and its ingredients. Listen to this episode in full and then combine it with the episode on Persia a while back, and you might get kind of an idea of East African cuisine today. Persian-style rice with saffron, cloves, and cinnamon, pomegranates. Even later on, Indian food hits it big around here, especially in terms of pickling and chutneys. So that's Central and East Africa in brief, but other Bantu peoples went further south still. They eventually re-encountered their now Eastern Bantu cousins. Both groups continued onward into Mozambique and modern South Africa, bringing sorghum, yams, plantains, and sheep and cattle with them, amongst other crops they'd picked up along hundreds of years of migrations. Only in the Namibian deserts on the Western Cape, not coincidentally where low rainfall prevents sorghum from thriving, was the vast Bantu expansion and takeover of sub-Saharan Africa halted. Now, with Bantu influence spread just about everywhere, Africa is starting to look a bit more like the rest of the world. That's just the power of farming. Once it takes off, and so do the populations, there's just almost no stopping it. Wave after wave of migrating farmers leaving crowded places happening over generations. All in all, it took more than 6,000 years from the first signs of farming in West Africa for agricultural civilization to make its way to the most extreme southern end of the continent. But now, it had reached every corner of Africa. That doesn't mean it was the most popular form of subsistence everywhere, but by the end of the Bantu expansion, pretty much every region of the continent had been introduced to some kind of farming, or at least traded some of their own goods for some agricultural ones. Those farming and foraging societies continued to interact, and to ebb and flow over the centuries, creating a rich patchwork of different cuisines which survive to this day. The legacy of the Bantu people's food is full of hearty, starchy porridges made from yams or plantains, depending on what region we're talking about. Meals in Bantu societies were generally served family style, with everyone taking from the giant communal platter of starch and grazing over other sides of grilled river fish, meats, stews, greens. Spinach stew, actually, is a popular staple, cooked almost like an Indian saag, but with the addition of nut butter. Another stew is made primarily with groundnuts, and usually some veggies and spices like okra and ginger. Very unique, very strong flavors going on here. Okay, just hold on there, AnthroChef. I promise we're gonna talk dinner soon enough, but we're not quite through the historical timeline just yet. Our next big milestone takes place many centuries after the Bantu expansion, but it begins in the same place, back in West Africa, where it all started. Things changed for this region once again in a big way with the introduction of a new domestic animal. The arrival of the camel, a hardy, domestic beast of burden, opened up the Sahara Desert to crossings, and thus a whole new avenue of trade. Merchants and caravans came down with goods from North Africa and beyond, seeking to exchange them for abundant West African gold, ivory, and salt supplies. The dry regions of West Africa, bordering the vast desert, became more developed than ever before, and soon several large urban centers based around trade had popped up, most famously Timbuktu, the distant other side of the world to Europeans, but just around the corner in West Africa. By the time Europe was in the darkest part of its dark ages, once irregular trade routes in the Sahara Desert had become a bustling, camel-fueled economic network that stretched across the sands from Morocco down to the Niger River. In the process, the Islamic faith spread into West Africa and became dominant just like it did everywhere else it went. Out of this setting came the Ghana Empire, whose exact start date remains uncertain, but which had risen to found a significant territory and culture in Northwest Africa. Thanks to the oral tradition and lack of written records, we don't know much about them today, but their mark on African identities was strong enough that much later on, the first sub-Saharan territory to gain independence from colonial Europe, the Gold Coast, named itself Ghana in honor of this medieval empire. Ghana eventually declined like all empires do, but its legacy would be taken up by the even more famous Malian Empire, which took over the scene in the 13th century AD, including taking over Ghana territory as its own vassal state. Mali, like Ghana, would leave quite a mark on African language, laws, customs, and mythology. But the way that Mali would exceed its predecessor was by making quite the impression on the rest of the world at large as well. Thanks to those West African gold supplies, Mali became most well known for the wealth of its rulers. After one in particular, Mansa Musa, which just means King Musa in Malian. Mansa Musa was a devout Muslim and decided one day, like all good Muslims, to make a pilgrimage to Mecca. Only unlike the typical pilgrim, Mansa Musa took his entire royal entourage and much of his wealth along with him. In 1324, he set out with 60,000 men dressed in fine silks, including 12,000 slaves, who each carried 4 pounds of gold. 80 camels also carried 50 to 300 pounds of gold dust each, and all the food and necessities to feed this traveling empire in miniature came along too. As he made his way north and east, Mansa Musa learned a lot about the Mediterranean world, and the Mediterranean world learned much about Mali and Mansa Musa, mainly how obscenely rich he was. Musa gave away gold as fast as he could to the poor he met along his route, which were many. He traded even more gold for products and souvenirs, donated to cities, funded construction projects and infrastructure wherever he went, and supposedly just had a new mosque constructed every Friday wherever he was. Clearly a pretty good guy with his heart in the right place, but this spending was so generous and so much West African gold poured into the Middle East that the price of the precious metal was severely devalued and other goods prices spiked. Inflation and a 10-year gold recession was the result. On his way back home, Musa realized what he had done, that he had destabilized the entire economy of a continent and more with his personal fortune. So he borrowed as much gold back as he could carry, at high interest rates, to help fix the problem. This is a notable moment in history, the only time that one man had direct control over the price of gold in the Mediterranean world, and beyond that, he tried to do the right thing with that power. Besides being just a fun story, Mansa Musa and his pilgrimage is so important because everyone he encountered along the way wrote about him and showed us so much about West Africa that we might not otherwise know. Mainly, that it was proven beyond any possible doubt that south of the Sahara Desert existed big African kingdoms, ruled by fabulously wealthy and opulent kings. And think about this. If we know that from just one guy who ventured out and made a huge impression, imagine what else we don't know. It boggles the mind how much history has passed and been lost in sub-Saharan Africa, and Mansa Musa's story proves it. This wasn't a chief from a tribe or even a king of a big city-state. This was a rich civilization. West Africa's version of that concept was broader and more connected to the rest of the world than the lack of written records would indicate. Just really quick, to not get off topic, although the gold is the most famous commodity here, food and agricultural supplies were still essential in Malian society. Sorghum and millet were the primary staples still, and fed the population with grazing cattle, sheep, goats, and camel societies on the northern borders, all controlled by the central authority of the Mansas. The Malian Empire lasted for 400 years, until it too declined in the 1400s, and was supplanted by an ancient kingdom that had recently grown up quite a bit, expanding into an empire called Songhai. Once again, we don't know too much about this territorially largest West African empire, but perhaps most notable is the now full ascendancy of the Islamic faith. By the time they had the clout to, Songhai kings had spread Islam wherever they conquered and controlled, building many Islamic schools and reaching their zenith in the 16th century, when they formed major alliances with the caliphs of the greater Islamic empire at large. After one too many civil wars, Songhai was conquered by Morocco, ending this great trifecta of the medieval sub-Saharan empires, Ghana, Mali, and Songhai. Okay, I'm getting a little dizzy in this whirlwind tour around an entire continent. How about you? This has definitely been way too many cultures to pack into one episode, but hey, that's the world history podcasting life. Either way, I think it's time to take a lunch break and talk more about the cuisine all of the people in these empires were consuming, and what elements of those foods persist in Africa today. One thing sub-Saharan cuisine has in common with the rest of the world is its love of carbs, but here it's on another level. Africa's situation is a little different. In all the other centers of urban society around the world, you get these sort of domestic supergrains that are extremely universal across wide swaths of area. Barley and wheat are just about everywhere in the Middle East. Rice takes over Asia, maize in the Americas. These grains spread and take over huge areas, taking their individual farming cultures with them. But in Africa, things are much more localized. Climate diversity ensures that no universal crop can work everywhere. Only sorghum or maybe yams come close to being ubiquitous, and they have some range but still aren't enough to spread agriculture across the entire continent the way it happened in Europe and Asia. Every culture and people has their own ecology, and thus their own cereal staple and food culture coming with it. Even geographical neighbors can have highly different staples and foodways. In this way, most African cuisines, and therefore cultures, are defined by their choice of starch, or rather, nature's choice for them, reflecting local geography and regional culture. We are sorghum people. The next town over, they're the millet guys. Most of us grow yams, some more than others, and we know people that went to live in plantain territory. Oh, also, we trade with the people who don't grow starches, but who give us buttermilk and animal hides in exchange for ours. Wait, we're gonna separate African cultures by their carb choice? At first appearance, this seems to present an obstacle to a chef interested in the flavors of history. With some notable exceptions, like great bread for instance, starches are, in general, boring, or at least bland. Cuisine is usually defined by the stuff we mop up with those starches, what sauces, stews, fillings, and whatnot are common. Not so much in Africa, and this is where I come back to what I talked about at the very beginning, of the simplicity of fullness being a virtue in sub-Saharan cooking. That's because this philosophy acknowledges what makes starches and carbohydrates so powerful the world over. They provide the raw calories that power our human civilizations. They may be bland, but they provide essential bulk and texture that makes a meal a meal. At an individual level, carbs make us feel full. And despite all the good taste in the world, isn't that what we're really after in the end? Good cuisine is based on the concept of fullness, what it feels like to have eaten. If a cook can make their diner feel the peak of full and satisfied, they are a great chef. As such, across many cultures in sub-Saharan Africa, what constitutes a proper meal has far more to do with its starch than its meat, fish, veggie, or spice component. This is almost like a truer, purer essence of what makes good cuisine, a totally different concept than we're used to thinking about in the West. One interesting side effect of this outlook is that even today, social class in much of sub-Saharan Africa is not so obvious in dining. Unlike in other parts of the world where the poor tend to eat rougher or simpler foods and the elite eat fancier, more elaborately cooked ingredients, people across Africa here tend to eat the same style of bland, starch-heavy cooking. There are plenty of different status people all over the place, of course. It's just that rich people don't usually eat nicer things, but more of things. They get the privilege of feeling even more of that fullness and satisfaction that comes from a meal. Typically, in rich and poor households, one major meal is served per day, with the possibility of snacks or small chops served in between. Additionally, there isn't a whole lot of differentiation between foods being appropriate for particular times of day, nor are there much in the way of different courses. People usually eat a lot once a day at a single hearty location, and everything tends to come out at the same time, rather than as separate courses. So that's the starchy African outlook on food and cooking. Let's discuss what is probably the most common dish found all over the continent today. You see, all these different carby staples can be cooked and eaten plain, or dried and ground into flour. But far more interesting and common is making them into something called fufu, which just so happens to perfectly epitomize this African emphasis on fullness. Deceptively simple, but quite a bit of work to prepare, fufu is made differently everywhere you go, but the basic gist is the same. A starch, or a combination of starches, any starch will do really, are pounded together in a giant wooden mortar. In between blows, the mixture is turned by hand and water is added slowly until you get a very sticky slurry. This mixture is usually fermented and then formed into a large ball or a rounded slab and served. When it's cooled off, little pieces can be torn off and rolled into bite-sized balls, used to dip, pick up, slather, or whatever with meat, vegetable, and fish sides. Fufu was believed to have been invented in Ghana, but it soon spread to become the heart of so many different regional cuisines, the bulk of the overall sub-Saharan diet. Fufu is just about one of the only things that does bind all of these many different cultures together. And it's such a great expression of African cuisine because so many different peoples make it, but they all make it differently. Just about any of the different ingredients we've gone over today can make fufu, and every region uses their favorites, often combinations, to make it into their own regional staple. Some prefer a very sour flavor, while others like zero to light fermentation. Fufu seems very basic, but that also gives it versatility. If you have a starch, you can make fufu, and Africans have done so for centuries with whatever was available. Even when all sorts of new ingredients, which I'll get to shortly, showed up from the New World, people across sub-Saharan Africa in general turned them into fufu, by far their favorite food. See, despite our cultural differences, we do have some things in common. And what Africans have in common is that fufu-based cuisine can adapt to just about anything. Once again, this gives the cuisine its superpower, the ability to adapt outside ingredients into its repertoire, and that's largely thanks to fufu being the ultimate base. I can't think of anything sweet, savory, bitter, sour, whatever, that wouldn't go well on it. So I think that about sums up fufu and the surprisingly refreshing African outlook on cooking and eating. But just to satisfy my Western culinary brain, what are some of the other foods we haven't talked about yet that go on the fufu and give it some distinctive flavor? One interesting one is kola nuts, which first grew on the tall trees in West Africa. Every star-shaped fruit from a kola tree contains seeds with natural caffeine, the local stimulant of choice in Africa, where people tend to slice them and chew on them in their raw and bitter state. Regular kola chewers can be easily spotted by their orange-stained teeth and gums. And if you were wondering, yes, with a bit more processing than is typical in Africa, kola nuts are of course the original flavoring for the first cola soft drinks and eventually Coca-Cola itself. We'll see in the next episode just how much African cooking ends up in American cuisine, but could there be any bigger contribution to American culture than the flavor for Coke? I have to mention tamarind, which most chefs today think of as an Asian ingredient due to its immense popularity there. But the reality is that sour, pulpy tamarind pods are native to Southeast Africa, and from there made their way to East Asia via the Middle East. So the flow of ingredients did go both ways, and the tart and pungent flavor of tamarind, which you can't imagine Thai or Indian food without today, was first a staple of sub-Saharan Africa. Across its pre-Columbian history, Africa made repeated trade connections to this Far East, both in ancient times before most of the Near East ever did, but especially once Islam took hold in late antiquity. Through their Islamic connections, Africans added Asian rice, Spice Island spices like cinnamon and nutmeg and black pepper, lime and other citrus, tropical fruits like mangoes and breadfruits, ginger, eggplants, bananas, plantains of course, sugarcane, and then coconuts and cocoa milk and cocoa water are all huge in African cooking today. To get to the rest of Africa's final typical flavors and ingredients, I need to briefly revisit what happens to the continent after the Columbian Exchange and the introduction of the slave trade in the colonial era. We've already touched on some of these foods in recent episodes, but not exactly from Africa's perspective. It was mostly the Portuguese bringing in lots of New World foods at first to Africa, at the same time they were visiting to buy human labor. Many ingredients trickled in along the west coast with these traders, including one very important one in particular. If Africa's culinary center is its starchy and bland staples, its most characteristic mark of flavor is its ubiquitous use of the capsaicin pepper, otherwise known as the chili, the pimento, the berber, harissa, piri piri, or just red pepper. Before the rapid adoption of hot peppers, spicy food of a different form was still around. Indian spices were other sources of pungent flavor before the Americas were discovered by the Old World. But in contrast with these expensive Eastern seeds, capsaicin peppers from America democratized spiciness because seeds could be grown locally. Africa is still immensely diverse, and some places don't use them at all, but in other areas, we can't imagine African sauces and meats without powdered, fresh, or crushed chilies. In a similar way, tomatoes and peanuts, also from the Americas, combined with chili peppers and became a very typical African flavor profile in many places. Throw in some okra, garnish with coconut or hard-boiled eggs, and you've got yourself quite a stew for your fufu. Once again though, Africa was not only on the receiving end of the continental exchange. Actually, African influence into the New World might have been even stronger than vice versa, thanks to the export of actual African people all over the globe, along with all their cooking, ingredients, tastes, their entire lives. We cover this in some detail in episode 22, But again, we'll see more next time when those African people lay the groundwork to invent early American cookery in the United States. But let's save that discussion for next time and try to finish staying in Africa today. While all these flavors flying back and forth between continents is the most interesting to me as a chef, much more historically important were the arrival of new bland starches from the New World, most notably maize and cassava, both of which, yes, Africans made into fufu. Maize fufu and porridge rivals wheat bread as the most popular and important starch on earth, thanks to its adoption by Africans. Today, it is far and away the most common and important staple crop on the continent. The African version of maize is spread out under many names in all directions. It's likely that it was the very first New World food brought to Africa, and it was definitely adopted faster and wider than any other. Of course, the story of corn in Africa is not a single story of the crop spreading linearly from one place to another and taking over the continent. Rather, it's just like the rest of sub-Saharan history, a complex and organic mosaic of farms, villages, and in some cases entire regions making choices based on their preferences and needs, adopting the crops they saw fit. The benefits of maize over old world grains were even more obviously apparent in Africa than elsewhere, thanks to widespread arid conditions and many regions with poor soil fertility in the driest areas. Maize could be grown in these places, and further transformed new corners of the continent into more farming-heavy societies. Maize started out as an exotic visitor in the 16th century, but by the 17th, it was a thoroughly African crop. 100 years after that, maize had almost entirely replaced both native millet and sorghum in West Africa as the staple grain, which was quite the upheaval if you've been paying attention. Interestingly, corn and sorghum plants look very similar, especially as seedlings. Corn was often referred to as sorghum from the sea at its beginnings, and I believe in some places still uses this nomenclature. As good as they had been for centuries, those native grains just couldn't compete with corn's ability to produce quickly and in more places. After a couple centuries, only north of the Sahara and the deepest parts of the central forest weren't dominated by it. Just a brief mention, sweet potatoes soon made their way over as well and make what I must imagine to be a pretty tasty fufu, but then, today, there is only one crop in Africa that comes close to maize's dominance and superiority, and it's also from the New World. Cassava, or manioc, yuca, it's the second most common staple in African cuisine today, as it too adapts well to poor soils where other crops fail and is easily propagated. Cassava arrived in Africa not too long after maize, but took longer to spread and get popular. This is likely because without special processing, cassava is poisonous and will kill you over the long term. So figuring out the processing techniques to make it safe probably took a lot longer. The root is the best part, usually made into fufu or some other starchy creation, like cassava dumplings, but the leaves can be eaten too, and are quite common in Sierra Leone and the Congo, where women pound them to reduce the cyanide content and concoct stews with onions, beans, and dried fruits, amongst other things. Africans of so many regions and cultures love cassava, and they grow more of the stuff than the rest of the world combined. So sub-Saharan Africa, just like the rest of the world, had its cuisine and staple foods radically altered by the Columbian Exchange and the new global trade network between hemispheres. While the preparations remained the same, old world ingredients were almost entirely replaced by new world ones, particularly the staple starches. It's hard to imagine African food today without corn or cassava. I think there you have it. as much information about sub-Saharan Africa and its foods as I could cram into an hour plus of podcast. In hindsight, this probably should have been two episodes spaced out, but it's too late to go back now, and personal criticism aside, I feel much better having uncovered this part of the grand story of world food history, however late and sloppily. With Africa now included in it, the picture is looking more complete as we fast approach the Industrial Revolution and the modern era. But we're not quite there yet. The story of Africans will continue next time when we see some of the specific results of all these people and cuisines being exported around the world. Until then, I won't yap on much longer. I'll just nag you one more time to please leave a review somewhere if you haven't already, and thank you for listening and for sticking with me. See you next time.